Where are we?
Well, we're on page 15. I think that's where we are. And the week before, the last time you were here, we were on page 7. So I'm going to make a, I'm going to do a very rapid review, a very quick review. I was subdued last week. Maybe you didn't notice, but I was. I was short of sleep. Maybe I was starting to come down with that cold.
No, you were getting over it.
What was the matter with me?
You had it.
Okay, I knew something
about it. You had the cold, you were getting over it.
She keeps track of this stuff. Back on page 7, there's a sequence kind of here. Is it not better to have boldness, energy, and confidence in oneself and one's powers in life? Many do just that. The Christian teaching of humility is antithetical to the doctrine of the strong personality that battles persistently and overcomes all obstacles. Strength is what we are after, but not human strength. God's strength comes to us by way of humility, and God himself is humble. That's what we have to remember. My strength is made perfect in weakness, said the Lord to the apostle. This is true of Christ. It is true of God himself. It is true of St. Paul. It is true of the martyrs. It is true of all of the saints. Our strength is made perfect in weakness. And it's something that we have a lot of difficulty in accepting and acting on. On the following page, page 8, the proud man is weak and is left with only his human powers, which are, of course, immeasurably weaker and less significant than God's all-powerful grace, and those strengths, dependence on those powers, they are the things that make it impossible for us to participate in divine strength, divine humility. The proud man falls, sooner or later having disgraced himself, perishing with all his self-confidence, plans, and calculations. That will start to be familiar to everybody who was here last week. Page 9, the spirit of self-asserting pride found a place for itself in the hearts of those who had become Christians, but had not fully assimilated the spirit of Christian humility. And in the West, there is a history of finding a way to take just enough Christianity so that it is still compatible with this worldly reliance on pride. And of course, it helps a lot that a doctrine was developed that said that we do not have the capacity of cooperating with God. Synergy as a possibility was lost in the fall. We are all corrupt. And so we are put into a situation where it wasn't that difficult to find a way to imagine a kind of vision of Christianity that accepted worldly pride and began to make actually a Christian kind of virtue out of it. People began to think that it could be compatible with Christianity to rely on confidence in oneself, one's powers in life, all the rest of that. I mean, it's incompatible with Christianity. It's incompatible with the nature of God. And examples were given by Archbishop Overky. He uses Arius as an example, where a man whose spiritual pride, reliance on his own opinion, his vanity, vainglory, almost unnoticeable to the person himself. This is true of anyone who relies on this kind of pride, spiritual pride and vainglory. It is unnoticeable to that person. And if you are convinced that it's compatible with Christianity, then you start to come up with heresies that make your dependence on the world and yourself and your vanity fit seamlessly with Christianity. That's what Arius did. That's what a great deal of the Western tradition has done. It very often compels one to preach one's own new teaching. And then you have confidence in that because you have confidence in yourself. And this springs from a soul contaminated by the spirit of pride and self-opinion, page 10. There is a kind of a brief reference to the history of the development of this kind of dependence on pride within what was understood and is understood today as being a particular type of confession of the Christian faith. So, well, you know, there are Christian churches that don't say that it is inevitable that there's a conflict between self-confidence and pride and vanity and the Christian faith, you know, because after all, we're fallen, we really can't do that much, we can't cooperate with God. It may be that God is humble, but we're fallen. And if you have a legalistic understanding of the nature of salvation, you can be saved and still, for good reason, because we're all fallen and corrupt, you know, what choice do you have but to fall back on your self-reliance and self-confidence and pride and success in the world? What can we do? We're fallen. We can't cooperate with God. We reject all of that. We reject all of that. Christ, God, came into the world in order to make it possible for us to be like him. And that other way, if we embrace it, we are embracing a vision of spiritual life that is, in the final analysis, not from God, but from his enemy. Now, here's something that we didn't pick up last week, and I'm going to try to weave into what we're going to pick up on. Let's see if I can do it. There is a reference at the bottom of page 11 to the development of this Western, sometimes Christian, sometimes self-admittedly secular way of thinking that is the origin and the history of our society and the way we do things in the world today in the 21st century. It began at the end of the 15th, beginning of the 16th centuries. I'm at the bottom of 11. By way of humanism, focus on human beings instead of God. You don't look to God to try to find out what it means to be a human being. There is an idea that we have a way of being human that doesn't have anything to do necessarily with God. God created us, but he leaves us alone to be able to flourish as human beings. The Renaissance, many heads were turned. The spirit of self-asserting human pride began to decisively displace the spirit of Christian humility. So humility is maybe optional for Christians. The cult of the satiated, that is, fulfilled by way of the things of the world and possessions, healthy, beautiful flesh, all of the paintings of by Raphael and the other great painters of the Renaissance, was essentially humanity's rejection, renunciation of Christianity, and a return to pagan ideals. Opposing the spirit of humility and obedience with the spirit of self-opinion, self-assuredness, and the idolization of human reason. These things are incompatible with a life shared with God through Christ and the saints. Christian religion was replaced by man deifying humanism, indoctrinated in pride, self-opinion, self-confidence in one's powers, abilities, and unlimited possibilities. Man stopped striving towards spiritual perfection. What can we do? You know, even we who are converts, sometimes we despair of this. All of this business telling us about how we ought to be moving toward spiritual perfection. We get discouraged. Because why? Because we rely on ourselves. And we can't accomplish it. Well, of course not. That's never been taught in the ancient Christian teaching. It's an effort on the part of we who have confidence in ourselves to try to attach to it the fullness of Christianity without abandoning our self-reliance. This humanism that developed in the West encouraged us as human beings to see ourselves as perfect even without divinization, even without spiritual perfection. It's kind of the other side of the coin of the idea that we are corrupt. Okay, we're corrupt, but we're stuck with ourselves. We do the best we can in the world. You get kind of tired of that and realize, hey, we can prosper by devoting ourselves to the world. We have all these capacities. We develop science. We develop technology. It's all an intentional project that builds us up, makes us even more prideful. A vision of ourselves develops in the West of human beings as a man-God already, not Christ, that we are already, there's something divine about us as human beings, and everything is permitted for us. There are no barriers. We can just keep developing, keep developing our society, keep developing our possessions, keep developing our technology. Then, of course, all manifestations of the passions and all means of pleasing the flesh are lawful. Serving the flesh comes first. And I gave the example of somebody who came in and was shocked. You know, there was a visitor and to discover that we had bad things to say about passions and desires, whereas those are the things that inspire us. If they're taken away from us, if somebody gives us a humility pill, which we spent probably too much time talking about last week, what if there were a pill, if we took it, it would make us humble? I mean, honestly humble. Then we would not be able to do all these things. We wouldn't be able to rely on ourselves. We would have genuine humility. So, and the thing that I wanted to pick up is this, there is a culture, according to Archbishop Averke, all human culture created under the good influence of the idea of Christ's teaching can be called Christian culture. There is a, according to Archbishop Averke, a way of using the things of the world that is humble. We don't have to reject technology. You know, on the Holy Mountain, there's an ideal of integrating to the degree that it doesn't interfere with the primary purpose of spiritual life on the Holy Mountain. They have not completely banned computers. Everybody is not there just disappearing into them as individuals the way we are, but they use them to a positive purpose without letting them undermine the primary purpose of life. And our idea when it comes to technology is, if it's created, I want it. If there's a new one, I want that one. If there's a one that is faster or has greater capacity, we want that one. And we're just controlled by our technology. You know, we disappear into it. There's no choice, no selection. But there is such a thing as the possibility of a Christian culture where we evaluate what fits and what doesn't fit. And if it's something that destroys us, we get rid of it. We get rid of that and use the positive capacities of human development, of practical knowledge and our technology. So there is that possibility. The final thing, bottom of page 14, modern evil is rooted in the depths of the human soul. Mutual grievances that we have against others have against us, and oppression came from the fact that people had renounced the spirit of Christian meekness and humility and had become hard-hearted egoists. And if we are hard-hearted egoists, we are not going to be able to function as Christians. Due to the growth and intensification in their souls of the spirit of self-asserting human pride, they naively thought, people have come to naively think, that all evil came from imperfect governmental and social structures. We talked about this a little bit last week. You know, I thought about revisiting it. I don't think it will help. We'd have to have a course in how we got to have the kind of system that we do today. I think I said some things about this probably that I regretted having said, because, you know, it just requires too much background. So that brings us up, I think, to where we are today. Is there anyone, especially including Michael, who wasn't able to be here last week, would like to talk about any of the things that I've just tried to quickly review to make a kind of a transition from the week before last to today?
I don't really have anything on that.
Okay. Sharon? Jimmy?
The one thing I did think of is that, you know, the context from which the writer is writing, he's specifically talking about what happened politically it's not our politics, it's the Russian. He's looking at what's happened in his in their world. He was talking about what they had gone through, I think. You look at what do things he particularly.
Where are you? Where are you getting
14,
that?
14, and he's talking about how, you know, they went through socialism and communism, and I thought it was interesting that the ideas are similar. But
no, I don't think it's nearly that narrow, but you know, it's certainly reflected in the history of Russia and the Soviet Union. You know, what makes you think that it specifically refers to that?
Where he comes from. I think he's. There was
15
something else I
mentions
saw.
Socialists and communists too, but he's
right.
Talking about utopian dreams of idealistic socialists and communists.
Right.
In other words, the.
Vladimir, you know.
Okay.
You know, they had.
I just think that's just. You know, the next page on 16, he's talking, and we'll see that. The next, he's talking about a pre-war Yugoslavian poem, and so I just think that it's important to remember his context was.
I don't think it's that narrow. I really, really don't. I certainly don't think it only applies exclusively to that his context is his own Russian. Of course, he was born in Tsarist Russia. I don't know, he wasn't that old probably, but I don't mean when he was born. I mean,
right.
When he left.
No, all
you
know.
But, and anyway, making a hard and fast distinction between what happened in the Soviet Union and what happened here would be very narrow-minded and short-sighted on our part. Scientific materialism is the root of what happened in Russia. Scientific materialism is at the root of what has happened to our country.
Yeah.
It's the same problem. It's not a problem that it was unique to Russia. Their problem is our problem. I think we would have to be thinking in very narrow political terms in order to feel as though, well, we don't have that problem. We do have that problem. And there are a lot of the political part of it. We just don't have the sufficient context to discuss. But anyway, for sure, it comes from his experience. There's no doubt about that.
I think the one thing that is the same there's a lot of this the same. But what you mentioned before is the only way you can do whatever it is you're trying to do is by gaining power. So it's the gain whatever your beliefs that you gain that power and then you try to impose that idea on everybody else.
Right.
So that's the thing that transcends
the cultures.
All the way back to the beginning, I think.
Yeah. Well, back to the beginning of the change that he's describing as something that happened in Western history. And that change includes both Russia and Europe and America, no question, all together in the same bucket. Humanism, you could even argue, had a much more direct and profound effect on Europe and America than it did on Russia, at least until the revolution, which was violent and sudden. So we'd have to have more specifics in order to be able to talk about it in that way. Okay, and then he talks about a continuation of the same self-asserting human pride as the only thing that we depend on. And we do. I mean, for us not to be able to depend on that requires a great deal of intense spiritual effort and struggle. In other words, what is true in my own past, I remember that one of the critical points before my final discovery of Orthodox Christianity came when I recognized clearly that what was wrong with the world, which I had been very critical of between my teenage years and my late 20s, the same thing was wrong with me. What is wrong with the world is what is wrong with me. I am complicit and participating in everything that I despise about the world. Michael made the comment week before last that, and I was trying to bring this out from Averky's text, that what you're doing here, you're dealing with something inside of yourself, ultimately. Because all of this comes from within human beings. I mean, we are not unlike, we've mentioned, the socialist Marxists, in particular, if we're talking about Russia, it's not, not just socialism, but Marxism. And Marx had the idea that we are determined by history, the things that happen in the physical world, in the material world, in the political world. And Christians, of course, don't. We have today a fixation on whatever happens to happen in the physical world. If you want to, and the political world, you want to fix things, fix the politics. So, not yourself. But the fact of the matter is, the only thing that will make any difference, and the reason God came into the world and changed things from inside, is that that's the only level at which things can be changed. Any utopian effort, whether it's socialistic, or whether it's what, and I tried to use this expression the other week, and I'm not free to use it because today, in this particular part of this particular decade in particular, liberal and conservative mean the very narrow political positions of part of two political parties. But the hubris, the pride of the West is the liberal tradition that rejected the authority of monarchs, kings in Europe. So the liberal tradition overall in the history of the West means the rejection of authoritarianism. So if you're a European in European history and you want to say, well, I am conservative, there is a way in which you mean, I want to return to the control of kings and aristocracy. That's what I believe in. And this liberal business, having confidence in the people, republics, democracies, all of that, that is radical. You know, it was radical in the 18th century when we started this country. It's our tradition. And it's within that tradition that of confidence in us as human beings, rejection of kings, rejection of bishops, popes, the church, all of that, instead confidence in ourselves. That's our tradition. And it's as much at issue as socialism in Russia after the revolution. It's part of the same thing. It's part of the same thing. I tried to say something like that the other week, but it's, you have to take in all that big chunk in order to be able to think about it. That kind of humanism, it won't work. It's a utopianism. It's a utopian ideal for us to be able to remake the world using technology, using confidence in ourselves, our theories of economics, and all our ability to change the world by self-dependence. That's what he's rejecting that, whether it's in Russia, whether it's in Europe, whether it's in America. It's all part of the same big ball. That, I think, is an important thing. And over all this hangs the specter of destruction of not only all of mankind, but even our entire planet, near the bottom of page 15. This new faith, this faith in oneself, rather than in the one true God. And then, as Jimmy's pointing out on page 16, there is this poem on the next page. It's faith in the Antichrist. It certainly was the faith of Marxism and Soviet Union, but I would say that it is also the faith of secularized Christianity in America, as Christianity has developed in the West. It is not a faith in God. It is a faith in ourselves. And
it seems to pervade all any political system I can think of. If you think of capitalism and any of them I can think of, it's all, you know, it's an American ideal that, you know, there are posters about it. You can see posters on the wall, and it's put up as a, you know,
the highest ideal that should unite us somehow.
You know, we believe in yourself.
Believe in yourself. Our God, this God, Ahasuerus, or is there different spellings of it?
I would Ahasuerus.
Ahasuerus, that's fine with me. If you look it up, you'll find that he was king of Persia. It's another name for Xerxes. He was the father of the Persian ruler Darius, a kind of pagan god king. But he is using this expression in this poem to refer to ourselves as this god king, Ahasuerus. He is an image of us. He is the image that we affirm, the image of ourselves as the ones who are powerful. That is our new God, our new faith. It's about our might, our will. Believe in yourself. That is the great new faith. And it is the faith of the Antichrist. And we teach people in grade school, believe in yourself. Have more self-confidence. They say we're not allowed to teach religion in the schools, but religion is taught in the schools. It's this humanistic religion, and no alternative is permitted, because any traditional religion, frankly, would call that religion into doubt, and that religion is no longer holding things together very well either, even at a secular level. So page 17, we could go on, or we're into new material now. Let's go ahead and talk about this.
You know, what this idea here, to me, and what you said, I think really point on that it's presented as though that's the neutral thing that we all believe in.
Right.
That's not any religion at all. It's neutral. We all believe in this, whether Roman Catholics or Orthodox. I don't hear that in Orthodoxy, honestly. Anywhere in the West, that's put forth as being. And I think that's what some of my real aha moments I've had in these Wednesday nights. Like, well, no one ever mentioned that to me before. And I think it's the beginning to separate some of those ideas that have to do with you know, self-asserting human pride, which Bishop Oberke so describes so well. it's shown, but it's, you know, Benjamin used to have, when he was in high school, have pride in your school.
Sure.
And he would just laugh at it. He said, "Dad, I'm supposed to have pride in my school, you know. How do I do that as a Christian? How can I go have pride in my school? What does that mean, you know?" And I tried to make what they mean is, but really I don't have any good answer for it. We assert, and you had a
really team assert. Spirit.
Yeah, but it's, yeah. It's the whole idea is just not a, it really isn't a Christian idea, and that's becoming.
Well, it's play. I mean, we won't, you know, I mean, we can go and
sure,
enjoy rooting for the Milwaukee Braves or something, or no, it's the Atlanta Braves. Sorry to see how old I am. we can go enjoy rooting for the Atlanta Braves. I'll take that part out. But, and I mean, is it evil?
Well, no.
No.
It's how we, if we become so involved in it, and
we can,
it does become part of our
can.
Identity, and that, you know, I've seen that happen.
I think the identification with that sort of thing is a means of asserting one's pride.
Yes, it's an outlet. It's an outlet where all of a sudden it is freely encouraged and you can enjoy it. You can enjoy the experience of pride without being a great football hero on the field. You identify with it, you participate in it. It's the same thing as with the king, with Xerxes. Exactly the same. You know, I mean, I've never thrown a football in my life, but I did badly, but I followed Boyertown High School when we went to the Chessmont Championship and enjoyed all of those emotions vicariously. And we don't. You can find other more scarier examples in our public life.
Yeah.
Why are people? Well, I won't go into that because it's too much. But yeah, and it's not that it's evil. It's that you need to, that you can't be carried away by it. You know. Mm-hmm. You have to see it for what it is. You have to become. We have to become more self-aware. On top of 17, he says, continuing, this new faith, this faith is fostered sometimes quite successfully in our youth, in the majority of our schools, youth organizations, circles, in faith in oneself and one's God. We all believe in God in America. And what God is it that we believe in? There is no evidence of a sobering up among people and no desire to return to the uniquely saving spirit of Christ, the spirit of meekness and humility. Okay, I think we've got this. We're pretty much in sync with Oberke here. Our faith is in Christ and Him crucified. Our salvation is in this and only in this. And that's the end of chapter 1. Chapter 2, the importance of spiritual discernment. And we are engaging in some spiritual discernment here with our reflection on our society and the roots of these things that he's encouraging us to think about. Generally speaking, that person who exhibits the best personality traits, a person who is good, warm-hearted, is usually called an affable, soulful man. Why then cannot such a person understand that which is from the Spirit of God and even consider it sometimes foolishness? So there is, he's asking, you know, we are good-hearted people. We're not committed to something terrible or evil, but we have problems. Some of us are sensual persons who cause divisions and do not have the Spirit of God. Who are these sensual people? Why does the Word of God speak of them disapprovingly? The concept that a person consists of body and soul is too elementary, too primitive. In fact, a person's makeup is more complex. And here he's going to hit us with some of these wonderful, most wonderful things in these two chapters so far. Below the small type paragraph, the soul is the life source in every living thing, and nothing more. The soul, bottom of the page, in quotation marks, soul, is to be understood as the life force, that which gives life to an otherwise dead body, and nothing more. The person who wants to save his life, his soul, is he who holds on too dearly to his earthly life, will lose it. But the person who gives up his soul, his life, for Christ and the gospel, will be the only one who gains true life. So what we are committed to at the level of our soul makes a difference. You know, it's not enough for us to have, be a person of an affable personality, a soulful man. There is this problem that he's pointing out about the soul being one way or the opposite way spiritually. A person's nature has a triple makeup. This is just below the center of page 20. A person's nature has a triple makeup consisting of a body, a soul, and a spirit, with the highest being the spirit. And we've run into this in Dee Pennock's book, where she goes into it in some detail. The soul, although higher than the body, is, according to St. Theophan the Recluse, entirely directed toward the ordering of our temporal existence, our earthly one. And here, I think, is an answer to something that comes up. In my world religions course, it comes up, but a lot of times people will say, or people who come and visit, you know, they will say, because they're a member of the society outside and they don't really have a problem with it essentially, they're looking for something spiritual. And then, you know, you'll hear the comment, well, I believe in spirituality, but not religion. Well, we all have souls. There is going to be an involvement in spirituality, but it could be a spirituality of the world. It could be a spirituality that is devoted to ordering our life and making it meaningful in terms of our own worldly experience. There is that kind of a world-oriented religion. There is a possible religious dimension to a worldly life, because human beings are body and soul. And this is something that we don't usually take into account. The last three sentences on page, lines I should say, on page 20. The activity of the soul is directed toward the fulfillment of the demands of the temporal life. And so there has to be a conversion of the soul. Therefore, the soul is a lower principle compared to the spirit. It's a matter of orientation. It needs to be body, soul, spirit, oriented toward that which is beyond this world. If it's the other way around, the body will try to fulfill itself with the spirituality of a soul that is in love with this world and the love of participation in a death, you know, ultimately, because you have some bones completely oriented in an upside down kind of way. Spiritual life, I've written myself a note, is about constant reorientation toward and movement toward Christ God. I remember talking to catechumens about this and using the example of a compass. A compass automatically points in one direction, and we have to change our compass. You know, to be changed would be to make our compass point toward God and instead of toward the world, so that our soul fulfills itself in a godly way rather than fulfilling itself in a world-oriented way. And conversion, repentance is admission that we are functioning in that disoriented way and being willing to struggle against it, and that is asceticism. It's absolutely essential. We can't be Christians without it, because we'll just find some way of accounting for Christianity that fits in with a spiritual way of living a worldly life. And then Christianity will be just something on the side, you know. It's beautiful how the West solved the problem once and for all by saying, well, we fell, we can't participate in that, we're corrupt, we're in the world, God saves us, but it doesn't really change the fact that we're in love with the world, our spirituality is a worldly spirituality. It's kind of justified. We're off the hook.
Seems to me that most people understand the body and the soul, but they don't understand the spirit or right. even acknowledge the spirit. And we think, or I think we're taught, or maybe a lot of people are taught, that the body and the soul are the fullness of our nature, so that, you know, if we're sort of religiously or spiritually oriented, then the soul is the part of us that is eternal, that goes to heaven.
That's just simply, well, of course, that's simply pre-Christian.
It's pre-Christian?
Sure.
Okay. But I mean, isn't this a more common understanding among people who think of themselves as Christian?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a form of paganism.
Is it really?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the ancient Greeks and Romans, they believed the body is the prison house of the soul. When you die, the soul is released from the prison house of the body and ascends. How different is that from man in the street Christianity? And so it's pie in the sky and a sweet by and by. It's not Christianity that believes that. It's this secularized version of Christianity that is popular Christianity.
But what's being put forth here is that the soul is really more connected. I mean, it's really more connected to the body than to the spirit, even though it is
it's about the fulfillment of the demands of temporal life. After all, we are created beings. We live in time and space, but there is something higher. A lot of times when people talk about spirit, what they mean is emotion, passion, feeling.
That's part of the soul, though, right?
I think it's something that's being done more than it is a constituent part, I would say. Something that's happening, something that's going on. It's a spiritual condition, I think. You know, and to be bound by the passions, for example. You know, because the real key truth is that we are free, and we are not determined by our body or by the soul's determination to accomplish the fulfillment of the demands of temporal and worldly life. There is more to us than that, obviously, and we're not satisfied with it, and that speaks to the fact that there is also the spirit, and it can orient one way or another. Well, if our spirit is oriented toward the things of a worldly soul, then there are going to be passions and desires. The body wants, it has its wants and needs. The soul has its wants and needs. Spiritual intellect, remember, eventually we'll get to the nous, is our capacity to discern at a level higher than the soul's determination to fulfill itself. But if that's not functional, then we're ruled by passions and desires that come from the body and the soul. So I think they come from the body and soul, but it's part of our activity in the world, I think. That's how I would think of it. page 21, the life of the body consists of satisfying the needs of the body. In the life of his body, human does not in any way differ from other living animals. These needs center on the fulfilling of, this is the bizarre thing, it always strikes me as bizarre. You know, in nature programs, you know, they want to find out what people are like. They look at animals, see what animals are like. What are they doing? Look, they do this, they do that. See, we're like them. Yes, when we live like animals, we are like animals. If you want to explain our animal nature, you can study the animal world and find an explanation of the fact that we can live like animals, you know. But we have a lot of things animals don't have. How about that part? How about dealing with that part?
Well, they don't have the wherewithal to deal with that part, the people that are making those. They have cameras, and they have, that which they can observe, and they have faith in that.
Yeah, I don't know what. They're entertained. It's entertainment. I mean, there's no need to be. It's like, you know, football and baseball are not evil, and neither are nature specials. You know, we don't want to take them too seriously, but it's entertainment. That's the great secret. I mean, they're not. It's not that people who enjoy those, and sometimes I do when they're not too silly, enjoy them because we have already been indoctrinated by the way of thinking that is there, and they are pushing those buttons. That's all, to please us.
I enjoy the photography, and I enjoy seeing the wonderful, you know, you see things you can't see.
Sure.
And learn things. What is that? That honey badger. I saw a whole thing on the honey badger and the way it eats snakes. It eats terribly poisonous snakes, if you've seen it. It's wonderful. But what I discovered, and we kind of have to chuckle at, is if you'll take the word evolution and the word God, they take the word evolution. If you took the word God and put it there, they replace it. You say, God created this evolution. They say created these things. It's funny. They just, like, there's no creator.
But the way they use the term evolution is an empty term. I mean, it's a filler. How much do you learn in an hour nature special? Hard content is really minuscule. Most of it is narrative. And they're kind of sad. And they've gotten worse. I think.
But they have the best cameras.
Oh yeah, the photography.
In the world. I'm like, how do they get inside that thing's nest and get the picture of a big boar? It's just amazing the kind of patience they have to be able to sit and do that. And now they have specials about how they did it too. That's kind of nice. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to lose your point.
That's fine.
Your point is about them saying, you know, they put us on the same level. We're like them. Right.
As an, and they, they offer it as a kind of explanation, as insight into our human nature, which is sad. The soul is given by God as the life-giving force of the body in order for the body to function.
I wanted Benjamin to draw this. This chapter so captivated me that I made a whole chart that wasn't very nicely done. I said, Ben, I want you to, here's more of an artist, take this and draw this out in some way that we can see the, because, you know, the spirit, soul, and you know, probably the Western idea to kind of separate it all out, but, you know, the things that the soul is interested in, the things that the body's interested in, the things that the spirit's interested in, and look at the, I had forgotten I read this, but
yeah,
I want to go find that to see if I can, do you remember that?
Yeah, I never ended up doing that.
I know. That's how that goes.
On page 22, he starts to talk about the brain. The brain is the organ of the body that the soul uses for mental labor. And the mental labor will serve the purposes of the soul. And they'll have, for the most part, they will have to do with the fulfillment of the demands of temporal and worldly life. And people can attribute a spiritual quality to that. It is a spiritual quality. There's a spiritual quality. I mean, there's a religion of that is spiritually evil. You know, it's spiritual. You know, I mean, there are spirits. You know, where the name of the chapter is the importance of spiritual discernment. Mm. You know, so we're talking about discernment here. The organ of feeling is usually referred to as the human heart, because all emotions, joy, grief, sorrow, pleasure, likes, dislikes, anger, or a peaceful disposition of spirit, which is also, he's saying, is a feeling, calm or agitation always resound in the heart, either by adding energy or slowing down its activity. The heart registers what is pleasant or unpleasant. It becomes the center of our life, the place where all that enters from the outside is contained, and out of which comes all that is within. The will controls a person's desires, and the will acts out through the parts of the body and those parts of our body in motion through a decision of the will onto the muscles and nerves. The activity of our mind and feelings given birth by the heart has an effect on the will, which results in bodily movement or action. Now, all of everything that he's describing, you know, can be completely oriented toward the world. Our will can be oriented toward the fulfillment of soulful and spiritual desires for fulfillment by way of the world. It is a spiritual desire that's trying to fulfill itself, after all. The soul will direct the body in a corresponding manner, controlling its activity. The life of the soul is about the satisfying the needs of the soul. The life of the soul consists of satisfying also the needs of the mind, the feelings, and the will. It wants to gain knowledge and experience a variety of feelings. This makes me think of a young person first setting out on their own and not wanting to be restricted in any way, but because you're free and you can go and you can kind of be like the prodigal and just enjoy the world. You know, it's because of this inspiration of the soul. Mere existence does not satisfy fully all the needs of the body, of the soul and body. Something higher stands above body and soul, frequently playing the role of judge of the soul and body. This higher principle in a person is the spirit, and its origin is divine. The origin of the spirit is divine. And this higher principle is the power which God breathed into the face of man. Animals have a soul, but the soul, according to Genesis, together with the body, was made from the earth. So the soul is earthen. This is a different way of understanding body, soul, and spirit than what we inherit from growing up in contemporary society. Human soul is in many ways similar to that of animals, but our soul's higher part is incomparably superior to that of the animals. This superiority depends on the communion of the soul with the spirit, which is from God. What is this spirit, and how does it reveal itself? Okay, comments, discussion. Now we're going to talk about the spirit. The realm of choice really becomes involved here. It's interesting to think that if we are oriented toward the soul's desire for satisfaction from the world, it's possible that we could simply not be involved with the divine aspect of ourselves as human beings.
I'm sorry, with the divine
aspect, you know, the spirit, which comes from God. You know, and then we can have the idea that, well, the spirit that moves me is, what is the spirit that moves a worldly oriented person? Well, passions. Passions, desires, they're what make life worth living. I remember specifically a period back in that that origin time of my rejection of things that I accepted in the past and eventual discovery of orthodoxy, where my condition was such that, and I remember writing, passion is no longer sufficient to move me. They had abandoned me as reliable initiators of virtually anything. It was not an especially productive period in my life. The ancients would call it melancholia, you know, this condition where it's worse than depression. But those passions, we rely on them. Mm-hmm. What if we had a pill that would kill our passions? kill them dead, or kill worldly passions. What would happen? This melancholia, though, this you know, it can lead to it builds up, you know, like a kind of this is an old spiritual description. I won't go into the origins of it, but it's a kind of pregnant condition that can lead to a new birth of desire, not for the things of the world, but for something higher, you know, and it can become a desperate condition where something comes alive of a spiritual nature and a desire that is ultimately, although we may not realize it at the time, is ultimately nothing other than a desire for God, can awaken out of that. Because in NA or AA, it would be hitting bottom. It's what they know as hitting bottom. But there's no, you're not on a drug. The drug that you were on is love of the world, and you bottomed out on it. I mean, there was a point like that in my life.
Well, the passions are like a drug, though.
Absolutely. Well, they sure. Yeah. And they have cycles, too, which is interesting. You know, and those cycles have been tracked. I remember being very interested in that at that point in my life. That, you know, and all of them can be tracked as far as a cycle. You know, that there's something that initiates them. We become interested. We participate. We become excited. We become embroiled in whatever passion it is. It rises. It reaches a crescendo, and then finally it drops. Passions are all like that. All passions are like that. They will drop you in the end. No. And you know, and it's. That seemed to have happened to me in a general kind of way. It was a miserable period, but good things came out of it. And I was saying something to Jimmy the other week about and it was Father James' brother. This is Father David now, I guess. Father David talked about world weariness. Well, this is like world weariness at a desperate level. A weariness of the spiritual life that is involved with the world, the ego, and all of that. You can reach that kind of condition.
But it sounds like, Father, you're saying that if you'll stay there and not try to medicate your way out of it, something really good can come from that. Because I think what happens is we get into that.
You could also get worse.
Yeah.
People in that condition sometimes do desperate things.
But if we'll wait patiently for God, maybe.
Yeah. A person goes one way or another. I think in my case, and this was my determination at the time, the fact that I loved someone is what saved me. Because it's something outside of yourself. Otherwise, it's possible to completely disappear inside of yourself. And there is no way out. Maybe, but there has to be something outside that is of more value to you than you are at that point to yourself. Ultimately, it's God. But if you love someone other than yourself, it's a kind of a testing point, I think. Yeah, if you remain, and you kind of want to be passionate about something, but it's
So we're talking about what he calls the tripartite nature of man.
Yes.
And what you're describing is
the fact that it can be experienced from inside, basically.
But it seems to me that it's the not being able to recognize the spirit part of the three parts and becoming completely immersed in the other two parts. Is that?
Yeah, that would be an accurate description. The problem is, I think, that we have not been taught who God is or what God is. We have not been taught mm-hmm. who Christ is. Mm-hmm. All of these ways of describing Christianity and religion that fit so nicely into a self-oriented humanistic materialism, you know, because otherwise they would, you know, real Christianity would conflict with them. Those are the only things that we've been fed. That's what people think Christianity is. And when you come into this, the desperation of this kind of condition, those things are not going to help because they all fit with what you have despaired of, more or less. Not despair in an emotional sense, but despair in the sense of the world weariness. It's not going to help you. I remember reading a book, No More Secondhand God. The God that we have been taught about, for the most part, is a secondhand God who plays a role in a secular society that is oriented toward the worldly fulfillment of a world-loving soul. That's the only God that has been preached to us. However, it is possible to discover the fact that we are more than that, than body and soul, in desperation, you know. Because after all, we are body, soul, and spirit. Right. Then there is a part in us that is from God. And if we, of course, then people say, oh, I have the holy essence in me, and we go off on another, we become religious fanatics that are still basically oriented toward ourselves. You know, I have what do the Quakers call about the divine spark or something like that. And you have a whole, you may be able to live the rest of your life, you know, having resurrected your love of the world and your soul, and you have another secondhand God, more or less. But there is a real God, and we are human beings created in His image and likeness. And if we need that badly enough, there is prayer, and God will respond to the desperate soul, you know, who desires a life of the Spirit. Saint Theophylact Reclus writes a lot about that sort of thing. So this is something that can be experienced, and monks experience it a lot. So we're being taught about this. What is the Spirit, and how does it reveal itself? Bottom of 23. Bishop Theophan the Recluse wrote, "The Spirit is a force proceeding from God, knows God, seeks after God, and only in Him finds its rest. By means of some kind of hidden spiritual sensitivity, the Spirit is convinced of its origin in God. The Spirit feels its total dependency on Him and acknowledges that it is obliged to please God in every way and live in Him and for Him." So I'm affirming that on the basis of personal experience, I guess. We don't do that often as Orthodox, but there it is. And in good old St. Augustine, not often quoted by Orthodox, but here he is, a great struggler for sure, if you know anything about his confessions, you know, and his spiritual struggles. What did he say about, Lord, give me the spirit of chastity, but not yet?
Who said that?
Augustine.
That sounds more like Mark Twain.
How does the Spirit reveal itself in a person? Three manifestations. This Theophylact is saying this. St. Theophylact indicates three manifestations of the Spirit. First, the fear of God. If we are in that condition, and we have the sense of something divine that is not us, the natural condition is one of fear. Because it's like for the first time there is something other than ourselves. I mean, it's like we have lost our ability to live from ourself, you know. And now there is an awareness of something other than oneself. It's possible, and it happens because we are body, soul, and a spirit that is given by God. And so it's a consciousness and awareness of something other than ourselves. Second, the conscience. Fear of God, the conscience, and the thirst for God. All of these come into play in the person and in such a person. All people know that there is a supreme being, God, who created everything, maintains everything, and rules everything. Well, we could say, well, but not all people know that. Not in our worldly condition where we are depending on the world and our love of the world and our world-loving soul. Do we all know that? No. But if we were to lose all of confidence in all of that, knowledge of God of the fact that there is a God is possible. And sure, there are atheists, but atheists are drunk on self-love, you know, and it's quite natural for them to be rebellious against anything that is not their self-oriented spiritual life. Why are they so angry? What are they upset about, you know?
The competition for their love.
They're in denial, you know, at a fundamental level. So, I mean, we should just let them fight with themselves in peace and not get upset about that.
Except that they should start fighting with us.
Well, we should pray for them. You know, exercise a little bit of spiritual maturity.
Sounds like what Father Theophane is saying, St. Theophane is saying, yep. Is that we all do know about God, and it's indicated in these three ways, our fear of God, a conscience, and a thirst for God.
Right.
Is it that we have to crush this within ourselves?
Crush what?
Like you said, there are
the substitution.
There are people who really don't believe there's a God. Is that because they've crushed it and crushed it?
Well, we're good at substituting other things in place of our thirst for God.
Loving for ourselves.
You know, well, the things of the world, we thirst for them. Our ultimate, the thirst that is in a human being is a thirst for God. But by way of the world, we want to go after substitutions. The thirst is really ultimately a thirst for God. But it becomes a thirst for the things of the world. It can't be satisfied. Anything, once we finally get it, it turns to ashes. It doesn't fulfill us. But while we were in that ascending part of the passion, we know that that's what we need. Because we're drunk on a desire for and a love of the world that is really a substitute for the thirst for God. Well, the condition that I described from my own past was a condition where there was no longer possible to believe that, because it's obviously not true. It is possible to reach a point in life where you know that all of that is just nonsense. It doesn't matter what you go after next. In the end, it will be ashes.
So it seems to me that he's saying everybody has the Spirit of God as a part of their being.
Well, we don't have it because it's not ours, you know, but it's a breath that was breathed into us.
Well, maybe poor choice of words, but I'm just saying, if that's part of the nature of man, then
our nature is dynamic.
Then we have the means to know God.
We don't have it.
So what?
Is remember, it's self-emptying, okay. Akesis. You know, it's not something that belongs to us. We are open-ended as human beings. We are open toward God. You know, that's why it's a longing. I mean, if we had it, why would we long for it?
Yeah.
It would be part of us. And there are a lot of religions that claim that we do have it, you know. But ours isn't one of them.
It's because of the fall.
What is?
That we don't have.
Thorns.
Is that why, Father, you would say that, or is that
why we don't have it?
Why we don't?
No, I think it's because a human being, in order to be a human being, must be in communion with God.
But we've lost that because of the fall, is what I'm saying. That communion was lost.
We're disorganized, and I mean, it's not that our nature has changed by the fall. It takes some time to describe the consequences of the fall. And
disorganized or disoriented?
Disoriented, chaos, you know. That's another condition, aspect of that, the experience I was referring to. I remember a drawing that was very important to me at that time, where all of the passions are turned against one another and at war. Within there is, it's called psychomachia, war in the soul. So it's a chaotic condition. And we don't want that. We want to be organized. You know, the soul does what it needs to do in order to organize ourselves within ourselves, in order to build up a stable way of acting in the world. And pride is part of it. And the love of fulfillment by way of the things of the world. It's a whole project. Well, even once you lose confidence in that project, then there's You can't do that anymore. And then you have this internal chaos. Well, all of that is, you know, body and soul. That's all about the psychomachia. It's a war in the soul. But it's, and what is it? There is no resolution to that other than repentance, which is more than the idea that we have something in us that is divine. That's not it. It's repentance. It's self-emptying. It's despair of oneself, of the possibility of pride ever resurrecting you into the prideful life and enjoying person that you were before. It's a conversion experience that I'm talking about. So it's more a matter. See, we've got all this stuff inside of us that we need to be ourselves. The problem is it needs to be oriented toward God and actively involved in ascent, which isn't the same thing as saying we all have this spiritual aspect. The spiritual aspect that we have is that we cannot be fulfilled within ourselves. The spiritual aspect that we have is that in order to be fulfilled, we must take all of what we are, oriented toward God, and move. Now, this could be a description of prayer. So, but it is a reaching beyond ourselves. Repentance has got to be that. There's got to be something actually going on. You know, otherwise it's not. It's not repentance. By confessing, the spirit venerates God and is filled with the fear of God. The soul would not know how to satisfy its obligation if the conscience did not rule it in this area. The conscience indicates what is right, what is wrong, what is pleasing to God, what is displeasing. If we are interested in knowing, if we are desperately interested in knowing, we can know. There is a way through the darkness. It's possible to follow. You know, an image that I used back in those days was the threat of Ariadne. You know, where it was Theseus who's lost in the caves, and you know, and is goes down to fight the bull, and there's a, how do you get out of this darkness? Well, there is a thread. Ariadne is a spider, a golden spider, and you follow this thread back into the light. So it is possible for us to wend our way out of the lost and dark condition of our soul. It knows how to do this. The conscience indicates what's right, wrong, what's pleasing to God, displeasing, what should and shouldn't be done. You'll know which way to turn right, which way to turn left. You will be able to make spiritual choices to get yourself out of this condition if movement toward God, the love of God, and real prayer is what you have got to have. Human beings have the capacity to move in this way, to ascend in this way, rewarding compliance with comfort and punishing non-compliance with remorse. And so you have a guide. It is no coincidence that the people call the conscience the voice of God. And if the voice of God is calling you out of the darkness, this is what you do. You start moving in that direction. So, this is a reality. Any other comments or conversation before we can stop on page 25? We just cannot digest chapter at a time, I don't think, in this book. And I'm not sure we're even digesting it. I'm just, you know.
Can barely gloss over a part of the chapter is what you're saying. Yeah. Again.
It bears rereading and rereading again, which was one of the reasons that I thought it was fine that we returned to it.
There's so much.
It's a graduate course.
You think?
It is for me. I'm having a hard time keeping up.
Well, I'm right here.
What's written and what you're saying. And
the ideas are, but the language is not. The language is not. I mean, the language is accessible to me. It's accessible, but it's just you have to take small bites and then see how.
That's true.
How does that? How do you sort out what you already understood? Oh, that's different. What all changes? You know, for me, I actually went and drew it all down because I thought, oh, this is different than I think. How do I think? And so I wrote a picture, which I don't know where it's at. I got to find it.
Interesting.
That chapter.
I did a lot of that out in the woods.
Did you?
Yeah.
I thought, wow, this is true, but I can tell it's true. you know, there's a ring of truth. This is the truth. This is the bishop of her. And I wrote it down, and I don't know what I did with it, but, and I can't believe I forgot about it just now. It was back in the winter that we were doing something.
Okay.